Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody joining us for another fun-filled, action-packed episode. And we have a lot of action going on tonight. We've got storms in Colorado, which brings us right away to Sam Bradley, our co-host. And Sam, tornado warnings, hail, what else have you got going on?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been a very interesting day. We've been getting rain the last few days. It was supposed to not rain again until tonight, but we had a huge storm come in early afternoon that produced hail, high winds, torrential rains. I mean, it's amazing how much flooding you can get, like 15 minutes. Fortunately, out here, the hail was fairly small, but I talked to one of my clients in town and we had some major damage. So I'm thinking there was other places that had bigger problems, but it's not over yet. We've been, it depends. It's funny because Kyle told me about this app to look at. It said tornado warnings or tornado watch, but then my NOAA radio says tornado warnings. So I don't know what it is. Anyway, we got that going on for at least another hour. So we have our wouldn't say second best, but our backup and very favorite meteorologist, Becky DePodman, who's actually at a baseball game, but it was gracious enough to jump in and so I could give her hell about this weather out here. What is going on, Becky?
It's just been a crazy few days for the Colorado Front Range. Today, that tornado watch you're talking about is literally the entire eastern half of the state of Colorado. It goes the entirety of I-25 all the way out to the Kansas border up to Nebraska, Wyoming. And then yesterday, there were storms, too. There was hailstorms. Longmont took a beating. And then today, much of the Denver metro, I saw reports of 2-inch hail, 3-inch hail near, like, Arapahoe, Arvada. There was a storm by you up in Greeley in Weld County, and I can explain why there was a tornado warning going off in your NOAA weather radio. So you're in Weld County, and Weld County is massive. It's like the 10th largest county in the country or something like that. But no, the National Weather Service alerts or warnings are basically issued for an entire county. The polygon won't show the entire county, but it gets sent to the entire county. So even if there's a tornado out in like Fort Morgan, or I don't know, that's still Weld County, that'll still come through to you in Greeley, even though it's, you know, 25, 30 miles to the east. So that would explain that probably. I mean, regardless though, you had some crazy hail, some flash flooding. There were storms firing all up and down the Front Range, just basically due to upslope into the mountains, into the Front Range. These storms fire right along that perimeter, the outer edge of the Rockies, and just quickly gain strength and move east and intensify from there. So Denver Metro got dumped on. I think this is going to be a pretty costly few days for Denver and for the Front Range in terms of hail damage, broken windshields, roof damage all over the place.
Yeah, and it's not over yet. I just got a lightning alert that was 4.9 miles away, so it's coming back.
Yeah.
But so far, I'm considering myself very lucky.
Yeah, I'm considering my parents very lucky, too. They're over in Windsor, and so far, everything's mostly missed them, but I've been a nervous daughter just keeping an eye on things. I think it's mostly just rain from here on out. I briefly glanced at the radar before jumping on. Definitely some lightning, some thunder, but I think the severity of the storms has lessened quite a bit in the last hour or so.
Oh, good to know. So, kind of, what does a week look like, Miss AccuWeather?
That's a good question. I haven't looked out too much. I think still tomorrow there's still a risk. But then I think this pattern hopefully breaks down a little bit and gives Colorado a break from this crazy weather. It's going to be sort of a setup from basically the Central Plains over to like the Ohio Valley is going to be getting a lot of thunderstorms. It's a pretty good risk for flooding all across like Nebraska, northern Kansas, Missouri, Illinois. So definitely concern for some flooding there for the rest of the week.
Oh boy, what fun. Well, thank you very much, ma'am. Thanks, Bex, and go enjoy your game and we'll move on.
All right. Enjoy the rest of the podcast, guys. Stay safe out in Colorado.
All right. Thanks, Becky.
Yeah.
Bye. So, Dr. Joe, tell me how wonderful it is in Memphis right now, probably.
Hi, guys. It's wonderful in Memphis, actually. We've had a pretty sunny day, and you know, there's some weather coming, but right now we're doing okay.
Great. Let's see. Seth is sending me a text. Seth, how's the weather in North Carolina?
Well, we're doing well. We get a little burst of rain, but I'm thinking if you've got lightning pummeling down around you 4 miles away, you may be more in the center of it. And I think it's a perfect wilderness medicine disaster podcast to be broadcasting in the thick of lightning and storms. And it sounds quite exciting over there.
Yes, it has not been dull. So we have a guest tonight, another guest from your book, another of your book authors. And it's a very interesting topic because we don't think about drugs in the wilderness, but in some cases, that's important. We're trying to get Nancy hooked up to the chat box on the left here. That's the text that Seth sent me. So just as an aside here, Nancy, there's a little box on the bottom left of the screen, and just hit that and it'll bring the box up. So, Seth, tell us about Nancy and how you got her hooked up into this chapter. By the way, what I learned about is too bad that Kyle isn't here, because she's another ski patroller and volunteer EMT, and of course that's what Kyle does. So, hi, Nancy, and Seth, jump in.
Yeah, we're so excited to have Nancy on the show here. She's got a huge history in wilderness medicine and in pharmacology, actually. So that's the topic we'll be addressing tonight. She's worked for a long time in the National Ski Patrol and in local ski patrols on local mountains. And she's also an editor with Wilderness Medicine Magazine and has a long history with the Wilderness Medical Society. And she's one of the few people that brings together doctorate level expertise in pharmacology with wilderness medicine credentials, which I think is really applicable to the disaster response operational environment, because we so often talk about medications that we like to deploy in disaster areas, we'd like to be able to access for patients during disasters. But we often don't get to talk about specialists in the area of pharmacology and how to utilize and store and interpret medications. And I think this is going to be a really interesting episode to have her on.
I agree. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. How is everybody doing?
Well, we're still in Colorado. We haven't flown to Kansas yet, so it's all good here. I guess things are finally winding down a little bit. So, you know, you really don't think about, you know, we've talked about different kinds of medicine that we might perform in the wilderness, but we don't think too much about medications. And, of course, the environment is very much going to color some of various things, what you carry, how you carry it, is it light sensitive, is it temperature sensitive, all of those kind of things. And like routes of administration, is that going to change in the wilderness? We'll start with that one.
Yeah, I mean, you have to think about what you're going to be carrying. The first thing you have to think about is what type of environment are you going to be in? How long are you going to be there? How many people are going to be on this trip? What sort of medical issues do you anticipate? And how much do you want to bring with you? So the types of things when you think about in terms of routes of administration are first, what's most convenient for people to take and for you to carry and takes up the least amount of room. And then also what's really important is who can give what. So when you think about drugs that are in a medical kit, basically anything that has to be given with a needle is at an advanced EMT level or higher. Anything that goes into an orifice other than the mouth, such as the ear, eye, nose, vagina, those types of things have to be administered by someone with a higher level of certification. So, again, depending on what type of trip you're going on, you have to think about what types of routes of administration are would be the most convenient.
Sam, you there?
Oh, Sam can't find the mute button. We're a little distracted tonight. Talking to myself, as always. You know, we all learn the rights that you have to learn when you administer a medication, right person, right time, right place, right med, etc. Does that change in the wilderness environment, or is there a different version of it?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't change, but there's definitely a different version of it. So when you think about the right person and the right person to be given the drug or the right person to give the drug, if you've got a group medical kit, which may you wouldn't necessarily see on an ambulance, for example, you just have a kit full of medication. But when you're on an expedition, you've got a group medical kit and you may have individual people's medications in it. But also you may just have general medications for the group. The important thing is if someone's medication is in the kit, it has to be labeled for that person. And any medications that are given from the kit have to be, and this is the same as in the urban environment, but the correct person has to be giving the drug. So if it's a prescription medication, if an intravenous drug should have to be given, it has to be given by a person with a higher level of care. And the key is just because you're in a wilderness setting, or it's not the wild, wild west, all the same rules apply. So again, the person with the appropriate level of care has to get appropriate certification has to give the drug. The other things you want to think about too are the route of administration. It has to be the correct route. But as we were talking about a couple minutes ago, the route may have to be different in a wilderness setting. Again, you don't want to have to bring a bunch of IV paraphernalia if you're moving all of your supplies for the trip and a medical kit on top of it. So routes may be different. The time, you always note the time that the person took the medication. If you're on a longer trip in the wilderness, if you're out there for an extended period of time, the person who is getting the medications may need them longer. So you have to take into consideration your supply of medications and also adverse reactions with cumulative dosing of a drug. Documentation is one of the rights, and it doesn't change in the wild, wild west. You have to do all of your documentation the same way. And then also you really want to look carefully at the patient's response. Because if you're in a wilderness setting, there's a whole bunch of other things going on. You're trying to get everybody moving through an extreme environment. You've got a sick person or an injured person that you have to take care of. You're giving them medications, and you want to make sure you're monitoring the response very quickly. And then the other thing is, again, you may need different drugs than you're carrying in an urban environment. So ideally, you'd want to bring everything that you have on a day-to-day basis, but you know you can't do that. So you really have to think carefully, and we'll talk about it a little bit later. Think very, very carefully about what you're going to bring in your medical kit for a particular trip.
Really interesting. I wasn't thinking in terms of having a group that has personal medications and needing the right scope of practice to administer those. Seth, what's your thoughts on what we're talking about so far? Oh, Seth. I guess he can't find the mute button either.
I had unmuted and continued to talk through the mute button. Apparently, it's mute resistant. So having qualified operators who can unmute buttons, and I think one of the big things that I was taking away from what Nancy's saying, I think is really important, is just considering the scopes of practice of people and what medications you'll be planning to administer. So in a disaster deployment, you want to be sure that your plans for potentially delivering medical care match up with the team that you're deploying and the skill sets that you'll have available, which teams like DMATs and others, I think, are very cognizant of and are prepared to do. If you're going to be, deploying a team with like one physician and a bunch of other volunteers, and that physician isn't going to be available 24 hours or around to administer things or replace that with nurse or paramedic, whatever it is, just remembering that there's still, even if things are relaxed in disaster settings, there's still a reasonable expectation that quality medical care will be delivered and that people doing procedures will be trained to do them. So I think that's a really important concept linked up with medications. It's not simply having a bag of medications you bring with you, but knowing that the medications you're carrying are within the scope of the people that you're working with and that you have the necessary equipment that you would need to administer them. And the point about IVs is really interesting too. Sometimes that will be the right thing to do. Sometimes just assuming that you can implement the same tools you'd have in a hospital in a remote setting is kind of extreme.
Yeah, and I confuse the issue by saying that a qualified person has to give a prescription personal medication. If someone has their own medication, you know, they can certainly take it themselves. They may end up putting it in the group kit because they don't want to carry it themselves. But if the drug was prescribed for them by a physician and they have a prescription for it, they certainly can take it themselves.
That makes sense. So, nurse medic Jamie, your thoughts?
Well, this is all bringing me back to the episode we did, the last two episodes on talking about the USAR training that Joe was on. And, you know, Joe, you and Patrick were talking about making those decisions about what meds you could take down into the hole with you when you were doing that, you know, getting down into the pile, trying to get to somebody. What could you take with you? And I think that these situations kind of match up with who is there in the hole with the patient. That are they qualified to give a certain medication, correct?
Oh, I think you're exactly right. You know, there's issues in, you know, do we have it? Can we carry it? Can we carry it in this environment? Is there a way for us to make this work, you know, under these circumstances? And so, you know, this is just another piece of it in that you've got to be able to have the right person with the right drug, right? I wouldn't send an EMT in a hole with controlled substances knowing that that's outside their scope of practice and they're not going to be able to handle it.
No, that makes perfect sense. So we're talking about a USAR environment here, Nancy, in case you didn't realize that's Joe's a USAR doc. So it's kind of a slightly different environment. It's different, but the same. So what are some of the kind of basic principles that you consider in medication use when you're in a wilderness environment? And I realize there's variables, but is there kind of like basic goals there?
Yeah, I think what you I think we sort of talked about that before, the principles of medication use. You know, the route may have to be different, documentation. So I think it's pretty much the same as what I talked about before.
Can't find that mute button again. All right. One of the things that strikes me is you could be in a very hot environment. You could be in a, you know, God knows, just about anything from snow to heat to rain. How does that affect some of the drugs as far as the stability of those drugs and so forth? You know, I imagine some of them are temperature sensitive, but how do you manage that?
Yeah. So what, you know, again, the types of things that you're thinking about, the environments, the different environments would be, you know, high temperatures, you'd be in a desert, of course, low temperatures, you're in a polar type of environment, high humidity would be jungle. Light exposure, some drugs are sensitive to light. So if you're at high altitude, especially in a snowy environment, you've got more light. You want to think about the effects on drugs of any kind of like shocks or vibrations. So if someone's on a ship for a long period of time and you've got drugs stored there, or if your backpack falls, for example, and the drugs are subjected to shocks, X-rays, anytime you go through an airport, you could potentially be affecting medications through the X-ray machine. That's not significant, but that's still something to think about. And then pests and rodents, anytime you store any sort of anything near food where animals can get into it, they may get into your medication supply as well. And so the types of things, so in terms of what types of effects these environmental conditions would have, so if you're traveling in a higher you're in a higher temperature environment, you're doing a rescue in a higher temperature environment, you know, hopefully the rescue is not going to take that long, but let's say you're on an expedition and you're out in a desert for weeks at a time. Drugs are susceptible to swelling. They can become inconsistent. They can melt. And some drugs can actually become inactive, especially biologics, when you think about something like insulin or antivenom or some antibiotics or vaccines. Generally, you don't take vaccines with you, but you could. There, you could have rabies immune globulin, for example. That would be unusual. But any sort of biologics could become inactive in higher temperatures. And then lower temperatures, anything is subjected to freezing. In general, most drugs do okay with freezing. There's certain drugs that don't do okay. But you have to think about the containers they're in. So if you have glass ampoules or glass vials and they're frozen, they could crack and then they'd be unusable. Anytime there's a lot of moisture, your medications can get wet. So blister packs are really ideal for traveling in a wilderness environment for a lot of things. They protect the tablets from moisture, from cracking. They're more stable in general in a blister pack. And then some drugs have to be refrigerated, so things like insulin. So you have to think about when you're traveling, especially in a hot environment, how you're going to keep something that has to be refrigerated as cold as possible, and that's tough. And then other things like medical devices, like glucometers, sometimes can give a false reading at extremes of temperature, so you have to bear that in mind as well. And then I'll just mention epinephrine. This is the drug that's had the most stability studies done on it, and if you look at the package insert, it should be protected from light and not refrigerated. So there have been a number of different studies of how to store this medication. And one that was done is if you're carrying your own supply, you can actually carry it next to your body in some sort of, someone suggested an avalanche harness. And that would be the most stable. If it's in a medical kit, in a general kit, has to be protected from light, which is pretty easy because it's in a closed kit. But it shouldn't be subjected to colder temperatures. So that's something that you have to be aware of.
Wow, that's all stuff I wouldn't have thought about. So Seth, you know, what's your experience with that kind of thing?
Boy, I think what this speaks to is a huge level of sophistication that we could bring to our disaster deployments and to our jump bags and bug out kits. And I think that there's real immaturity, not in a pejorative way, but just we haven't yet matured as an industry to really have thoughtful ways that we manage this particular piece of our equipment arsenal. So just hearing that, you know, for 5 minutes, you can think of all sorts of ways that you could break down the kit that you use or the medications that you're planning to take and have an analysis of how you're going to carry it, how you're going to administer it. And what this really speaks to is how each individual medication may have different considerations. So I know for us with deployments, with Outward Bound and other organizations, we've been looking at like Frio wallets that are really nice, relatively low cost ways to cool medications in like the Florida Everglades, where it would way exceed the temperature range for epinephrine almost immediately. And I bring up epinephrine because, like Nancy was focusing on as well, it's such a ubiquitous medication now. We say that it's really one of the fundamental things you kind of have to carry in a wilderness medicine setting. It would be ideal to have in a disaster setting because it can reverse anaphylaxis, that life-threatening allergic reaction, quickly in a way that other resources like EMS might not be able to arrive in time, but it's a very heat sensitive medication. So I think the idea that we could take time to analyze the medications that we're carrying and how we can protect them is really novel. It's something even in EMS we're not particularly sophisticated with, and certainly as we look to other organizations like law enforcement serving as first responders and carrying things like naloxone to reverse heroin overdoses, these are all like the industries where we just have this assumption that we can put the medications out there and use them when we want them. And I think having somebody like Nancy force us to take a step back and say, well, how effective is this medication going to be if it's been in a disaster response vehicle for 6 months, sitting in a parking lot, and then it's driven to Texas for a flood, and then you pull out the bag, which has regularly been reaching, 120 degree temperatures in the vehicle. So just to point out, this is such a great opportunity for sophisticating our, is that a word, sophisticating? I think we can sophisticate ourselves to be more thoughtful about this.
Well, kind of while we're on that topic, we want to talk a bit about medical kits and some of the considerations you have for the wilderness environment, as well as what kind of drugs are most important. You talked about epinephrine, which obviously is critical. What kind of medical conditions do you run into? I always think about the diabetic, because having been a ski patroller as well, you know, when people are taken out of their sedentary environment and suddenly hiking up in the mountains where you have altitude and you have more exercise, that's going to kind of throw their normal blood sugar off. That's just one thing that comes to my mind. But Seth, why don't you continue with that train of thought, and then we'll go back to Nancy.
Yeah, I can definitely share my own thoughts that the basics that we often think about are ways to address life-threatening conditions like anaphylaxis with epinephrine, and then also things to treat common conditions. So frequently, I think medical kits will contain items like pain medications to treat painful situations, potentially antibiotics, and we discussed that recently on the infectious diseases episode of this podcast. And then I think after that, there's a wide range of opportunities based on the environment that you think that you'll be in. And another thing I think that's really important to bear in mind, which is often sort of written off as easy to say but not always easy to do, is personal medications. So many times people will be deploying with their own medications that they need to use, as Nancy was pointing out. And so I think having systems in place to ensure that teammates can carry their own medications and know where they are and know that they're in carriage devices that will allow them to be effective and that they don't get separated from them, and then being aware of what those are and what some of the features of them are, is important. And I think one of the interesting ethical sort of questions that comes up is the use of medications throughout a deployment or throughout a wilderness environmental period for somebody other than yourself. So, you've brought your own insulin and you have somebody else who's having a diabetic emergency. And how do you kind of spread out now limited resources like that among people when you may have medications you need for yourself, but somebody's in dire straits of their own? And that becomes an interesting question about, resource allocation.
Well, not only that, but we always learn not to give someone else your prescription drugs. But like you say, what do you do when you're in that situation where somebody desperately needs it? I guess, that's kind of a logistical moral dilemma, perhaps. Nancy, let's go back to you on that topic.
I think with the types of things we think about as well, the major things that you might run into are wound management, soft tissue, orthopedic injuries. So like Seth said, you want to bring pain, items for pain management. So again, I have more experience with expedition type stuff and wilderness medicine type, like hiking trips and things like that. So it depends on who's on the trip again and who can give medication. So if you have a physician or an advanced practitioner that could administer narcotics and you have narcotics in your kit, it should you need that for pain, then that would be, you could use that. But ideally, you want to start with the simplest things possible. So oral analgesics, like over-the-counter stuff first. Like Seth said, you always want to think about anaphylaxis. So the epi auto injector, of course, is the most convenient, to bring, but it's expensive, you know, outrageously expensive. So depending on who's trained, and Seth can speak more to this, you can bring a vial of epinephrine instead of the auto-injector. But the auto-injector definitely is the most convenient. Wounds, you want to bring antibiotics, but generally oral antibiotics are the best to bring, of course, so you don't have to go to IV unless it's absolutely necessary. For seizures, that's another thing to think about. Instead of bringing parenteral medication, rectal Valium, it's probably less usual to need this type of thing, but if you are going on an extended expedition, you might want to have something like that for seizures. And then, of course, for any medical conditions like heart attack, aspirin, nitroglycerin, and for asthma, any sort of respiratory distress, you're not going to be able to bring oxygen with you. But if it is an asthma-type picture, that any sort of metered dose inhaler, albuterol metered dose inhaler, would be much more convenient, can be given by more types of, doesn't have to be given higher level care. First responders and EMTs can assist with it. So you're not going to be bringing a nebulizer with you. But in general, for any sort of expedition trip, the types of things you're going to see mostly are wound type stuff and occasionally medical things.
So, Joe, how does this translate to the USAR environment?
Well, I think a lot of the same principles apply. I actually was sitting thinking as we were having this discussion and wondering, is there any guidance or reference or just, you know, by the seat of your pants way to make an assessment on how effective a medication is likely to be if it has been outside its temperature parameters and storage parameters of any kind? Is there any sort of way to get some kind of idea of how effective that drug may be so that we could use that, you know, for our own calculations to some extent, being able to say, well, you know, I'm going to have to double my dose on this patient in order to be able to do something here?
Yeah, I don't think there really is. I mean, what, you know, a general principle, if things are not stored properly, you can look at the appearance of them. So if you have a parenteral product in a vial, if there's any sort of particulates or discoloration, absolutely don't give it. But if it looks the way it's supposed to look, the way you're used to seeing it look, and you know it's been exposed to higher temperatures, it's really tough to know whether it's going to work or not. You know, there's certain drugs that absolutely shouldn't. Well, there's very few. I'm trying to think. I'm thinking more in terms of expiration date, which I'll get to in a second. If you have creams, not as big an issue, but if you have any oral medications that are cracked or, again, are discolored, you probably want to stay away from them. But I don't think there's any way we can absolutely measure whether the drug is going to work or not, from the get-go. So, I mean, Seth, do you have any comment on that?
I'm not aware of any definitive resource that you could look to for a wide variety of medications. I've seen some cool concepts about ways to see if something's been exposed to an inappropriate range, like temperature-sensitive strips that you can store, like with, say, EpiPens, if you have them in a container. And if the temperature range gets beyond a certain way, it triggers a color change in the strip, and you know that they've been exposed to high temperatures. Whether it's still effective, yeah. And I think what the question is, which is a really good one, is how do different medications respond to different extremes? So say now you know that this medication has been exposed to some inappropriate temperature range or is out of date, which is a later topic. What does that actually mean for that particular medication? And, you know, that's a book opportunity. just to say, like, that's something that would be really helpful, I think, to operators.
Yeah. And, you know, there are data, there's studies out there looking at different, in general, different types of storage environments, but you'd have to know that going into it. So, and that's why this book is here, and other books to say, okay, if you indeed it's stored your stuff improperly, this is what you can expect. So then that's a segue into the expiration dating, which is sort of the same concept. So products in their original containers have the expiration date that's on the container. If they're taken out of their original container and they're put into a pharmacy, like an amber bottle, or they're repackaged into blister packs, then a different expiration date has to go on them. But the Department of Defense has this big study where it's called the Shelf Life Extension Program. And they have found that there are a number of medications that are that last much longer than their expiration date. And that is when they're stored at the temperature that they're supposed to be stored at. So the thing that you have to think about when things are not stored properly is it could have an effect on the expiration date, which isn't really an issue for a one-time situation. So if you're going in someplace and you're there for hours or a couple days, not an issue for expiration date. But like Seth said, if you have it stored in a truck somewhere for 6 months in the desert, and you pull the drug out and say, oh, this looks like it's in date, if it hasn't been stored properly, then the expiration date may be shorter, which means in general that the drug is less potent. So there really was only one drug, and this was years ago, tetracycline. Outdated tetracycline was known to cause Fanconi syndrome, which was caused renal dysfunction, and that is no more. So right now there really aren't any drugs out there that we know for sure that cause harm when they're past their expiration date. But in general, most drugs lose some sort of potency.
Well, that's good to know. Well, on that note, Nancy, is there some good drug information in the wilderness environment resources besides the wonderful book, which we'll mention in a minute?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good idea to bring, if you have the space and can tolerate the weight, it's a good idea to bring some sort of textbook or handbook. So there's a number of field guides to wilderness medicine. There's the Department of Defense has a Special Operations Forces medical handbook. There's a handbook, Oxford American Handbook of Disaster Medicine. So it's just a good idea to bring something along. Of course, there's a ton of stuff on the internet. And if you have service, you can access stuff on the internet, but that is something that shouldn't be assumed. So you really should bring some sort of a drug reference with you, or it should be in the medical kit as a resource.
Oh, those sound like good resources. So lastly, you brought up something I really found it interesting. What about situations where drugs are donated for medical missions? Tell us about that.
Okay, so if somebody's going to a country where they're going to be taking part in a medical mission, could be, you know, a disaster area, and they want to bring drugs with them, this is very common. You can physically bring the drugs with you, and TSA has specific advice on how much quantity you can bring, and how it needs to be labeled. I went on an Everest Base Camp trek with the WMS several years ago and brought a giant bag of drugs with me to base camp. So again, they're okay with you doing this as long as you have things labeled properly and the use that they're, you know, what they're going to be used for. The thing that people are tempted to do is to give expired drugs because they're like, oh, well, you know, they're only going to be thrown out anyway. We sort of know that they have potency past their expiration date, so it's probably fine. The FDA and the World Health Organization don't encourage that because, first of all, it's not very nice to assume that it's okay to give expired drugs to somebody else. You know, to other countries just because they may be poor or maybe in a disaster situation. And again, we just don't know whether the drugs work or not. So in general, if you're going to bring medication, make sure that it is in with expiry. But you have to be careful because if you're repackaging it, then the original expiration date doesn't hold. So you want to make sure that when you're repackaging things, you label them very carefully, and you have an idea of when the expiration date can be. In general, once you repackage something, you should put a year expiration date on it. But it's a great idea to be able to bring medications to an area where you know there's going to be a shortage.
Yeah, it's that probably word that can get dangerous. Seth, I'm going to throw it back to you, and I know you have a comment, but tell people about this book we keep referring to.
So we're super excited about this textbook. It's called Wilderness EMS. It's out from Walters Kluwer. It published this year in 2018, and it really took on the task of bringing wilderness medicine to an EMS environment and includes disaster in that purview. So it was the attempt to take a lot of the dialogues and technologies we have about field medicine in an austere wilderness environment, but with the presupposition that it was being delivered by healthcare providers and often on teams, which is kind of a novel concept for wilderness medicine in general, which is much more ad hoc typically. And it's available from all your major textbook retailers and on Amazon and from the publisher themselves. And Nancy has a fantastic chapter there with a lot of great graphics and gets into more detail on some of these topics. And she reminds me, as we're talking about repackaging, just to point out, I get this question very often, and I think it's worth describing why it is we can't carry prepackaged syringes of medications or other ways that you can kind of put together something that would be like an ad hoc auto injector or syringe and bring it to a call or to a disaster deployment. And it's the sterility is the issue. So Nancy might be able to speak to this more deeply, but the question often comes up, if an auto injector for epinephrine is $800 for a two pack, why can't we just get the same amount of epinephrine, like 0.3 milliliters, put it into a syringe and then just carry it in our kit? And you measure in weeks to months how long that's a sterile injection device. And that's one of the big technologies that the auto injectors bring to the table, is the ability to stay sterile and to carry something that can be injected into somebody, assuring that you're not introducing any infection. And I did want to throw out a query to the group, just because this is something that I'm asked so often and really curious what the disaster answer would be. But Nancy was talking earlier about pain medications and over-the-counter pain medications you might carry. And one of the favorite around-the-campfire dialogues that I often hear is if you are only going to carry one or two non-prescription strength analgesics or pain medicines, would it be ibuprofen or aspirin or acetaminophen, which is Tylenol, which it actually ends up being hotly debated, because aspirin is so critically helpful for heart attacks and is also very dangerous and probably discouraged in children younger than 18. So huge benefits and some risks. And people talk a lot about ibuprofen with the risk of stomach irritation. And acetaminophen bypasses all that and is great if you have any allergies to non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like aspirin or ibuprofen. But then you lose all the benefits of the anti-inflammation and any potential benefit for reducing mortality and heart attacks. So, Nancy, I'd love to just know if you were being asked, you know, this is for like a disaster team that's going to carry one over-the-counter medicine, and they could choose ibuprofen or acetaminophen or aspirin. What would be the kind of parameters you'd use to do that, or would you encourage them that they really have to carry more than one?
That's tough, because I think they all have use. I think all of them have use. You know, personally, I like the non-steroidals. And actually, I take them, you can take them with, well, yeah, you can take them with misoprostol or H2 blockers, you know, to alleviate some, well, this is a whole other discussion, you know, to alleviate some of the GI bleeding potential. But I think Tylenol has its use for people that, you know, may have susceptibility to bleeding or people with an aspirin allergy. So I think that's a really tough call.
You're making me so happy, because that's because that's my answer as like,
okay. All right.
As like, I can't sort out which one would be better. I love the idea of carrying two of them or two
take
of them.
Take them all.
That's such a frequent question.
They don't take that much room up.
No. Aspirin is teeny. Yeah. I think Aleve, actually, I think naproxen is the best. I think it lasts longer than ibuprofen. Ibuprofen's a Q6 drug. But yes, take them all. That's the answer.
One of the ways this question came up was in building, you know, commercial medical kits where it might be difficult to, you know, get somebody to understand why you carry all three. But boy, I love that answer because I think each one has such a different use. So anyway, thank you for helping me navigate that.
I'd like to get Joe's take on that as we wind down here.
Well, I think they summed it up beautifully, right? There's no single answer to that fits all the needs. And, you know, I was fascinated by the discussion over post-expiration use of medications and storage of medications. You know, every topic that we talked about tonight is something that we deal with at some point, almost on a day-to-day basis in EMS in general. And, you know, in a disaster situation, it just shows those things are compounded, you know, multiple fold and lead to a whole lot of additional issues, right? It's not like I can just decide that, you know, well, this time I'm going to go get some aspirin. So where am I going to go get aspirin? There's nowhere to go get aspirin. So if I'm going to use it, I've got to have it with me up front. So a huge number of decisions have to be made, a huge number of issues that play into what the, you know, what choices you make. And again, just another example of how hard disaster medicine can really be on something as simple as do I take aspirin or Tylenol?
Good point. Final thoughts, Jamie?
Well, I just think this has been a great discussion, and I always like when we talk about the Wilderness EMS textbook, Seth, is one of the things I like is how easily our wilderness discussion translates over to any austere medicine discussion. As I pointed out earlier, you know, whether you're out on the trail and hours from help, or you're, you know, burrowed down inside a building with a patient in an isolated location and you need a different medication than what you have in your kit, it might as well be in the same locations because you're stuck getting back to where you need to get more resupply and you have to make do with what you have. So it's pretty amazing just all the things you've thought about and the different authors we've had on here for the different chapters to discuss the various topics. And Nancy's just another indication of that expertise, really bringing some things to mind that we maybe hadn't thought about before.
Exactly. Just more educate. You know, every time we do a podcast, I learn something new. So hopefully we're educating our listeners out there as well.
Absolutely. And you know, it's like we talk with Joe on a regular basis here when we're talking about the types of things you do, Joe, with Paragon Medical Education Group and the different resources you pull together for the training you do for jurisdictions and services out there. You have to help them make these decisions on whether we're going to bring aspirin, Tylenol, ibuprofen, or naproxen, or all three, or what are we going to do with that? And these are things you bring to the table, not just as a discussion academically, but you have people that have been there and done that.
Well, that's exactly right. And it just, you know, again, it just leads to the discussion of how complicated a relatively simple problem can be when you put it in an austere environment type situation that just, you know, it just shows you how much that complicates things that otherwise might not be that difficult a decision.
So if people want to get you guys in and really talk to you, and I urge people to do that, I urge people to reach out and contact you guys because they really just don't know what they don't know about what you can do for them until they talk to you. Where can they reach out to you and find you?
You can find us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com as well as Facebook under the same name. And you can always reach out to us through the Disaster Podcast.
Excellent. Thank you very much again for your continued support. Seth, where can folks find you? I know we'll have links in the show notes for this textbook so people can find it when they find this episode. But how about if they want to reach out to you about some of the topics we've talked about?
Yeah, great to check out the links on the website. And we also have a Facebook presence under the name Wilderness EMS. So we'd love to continue dialogues like this. Nancy is available there as well as other authors. And we can continue the dialogue there. If you're on Twitter, I'm at the handle at Hawkvox, H-A-W-K-V-O-X. And we'd love to discuss things there as well. And there's also a specific website for the textbook that you can pick up on the website that you'd be loading, and that's bit.ly/WEMS text.
Excellent. And we'll make sure we have links to all that as well. Nancy, thank you so much. I'll make sure we tell people to reach out to you over at the Wilderness EMS Facebook page if they have any questions about this topic. And of course, you're always welcome to join us over at our Disaster Podcast Facebook group. We'd love to have you there. Sometimes we get people asking questions when we post our episodes there as well. So thanks again for coming on the show.
Okay, thank you for having me. It was great.
Fantastic. Sam, where can folks find you?
Probably hiding in my basement. That's not what you're talking about. In the usual social media places, under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 on our Facebook group, or disasterpodcast.com. What about you, Jamie?
Well, before I give my information, I just want to give a thank you again to Becky DePodwin, who came on and filled in for Kyle Nelson on the weather report today. You can always find stuff that Becky's posting over at her Twitter handle, at WX_Becks, B-E-C-K-S. And we want to thank her again for coming on the show. As for me, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media channels out there. Please friend, follow, or otherwise catch up with me over there. And, of course, on our Facebook group, just search for the words Disaster Podcast and you'll be able to find us that way and ask to join the group. We'd love to have you in there. We're well over 600 people in the group now, and we have some great discussions on a variety of topics there throughout the week, as well as our weekly episode posts on top of that. Of course, disasterpodcast.com as well. Just a lot of places you can find us in your favorite podcast app or whatever. We'd love to be able to connect with you however you'd like to connect. Sam, you know, we've talked a lot of things, but is this a topic, you know, pharmacology is not something we've covered a whole lot on the show in the past few years.
Well, certainly not in the wilderness environment or the USAR environment or the DNAT environment. So it's interesting to kind of juxtapose those three things and see what's similar and what's not. But I mean, this more than anything we've done is a discussion of medicine and disaster medicine not being our everyday medicine.